Late in the autumn of 1942, the newspapers were filled with accounts of the battle for Stalingrad. For a time that fall, it seemed as if the entire outcome of the war depended on the sacrifices being made by the Russian people. Weinberg later said that he and his friends suffered every day along with the Russian people. "No one can feel the way we felt," he recalled. "Even when we saw the sham of what was going on in the Soviet Union, of the show trials, we turned our eyes away from them." In November 1942, just as the Russians opened up an offensive to push the Nazis back from the outskirts of Stalingrad, Bohm began attending regular meetings at a Berkeley chapter of the Communist Party. Typically, 15 people might show up. After a while, Bohm found the meetings interminable and decided that the group's various plans to stir up things on the campus didn't amount to much. "I had the feeling that they were really rather ineffective." Gradually, Bohm just stopped attending. But he remained a passionate and enthusiastic intellectual Marxist, reading Marxist texts together with his closest friends at the time, Weinberg, Lomanitz, and Bernard Peters. Phil Morrison recalled that his party unit meetings were attended by many people who were not communist. It would be very hard to say which members were communists. The meetings were often like college bull sessions. They discussed, Morrison recalled, everything under the sun. As a cash-starved graduate student, Morrison was assessed party dues of a mere 25 cents a month. Morrison remained a party member through the Nazi-Soviet pact, but, like many of his American comrades, he drifted out of the party soon after Pearl Harbor. By then he was teaching at the University of Illinois, and his small party unit simply decided that their priority should be to assist the war effort, and that left no time for discussing politics. David Hawkins came to Berkeley in 1936 to study philosophy. Almost immediately, he fell in with a number of Oppenheimer's students, including Phil Morrison, David Bohm, and Joe Weinberg. Hawkins encountered Oppenheimer one day at a meeting of the teachers' union. They were discussing the plight of underpaid teaching assistants, and Hawkins recalled being struck by Oppenheimer's eloquence and sympathetic demeanor. "He was very persuasive, very cogent, elegant in language, and able to listen to what other people said and incorporate it in what he would say. I had the impression that he was a good politician in the sense that if several people spoke, he could summarize what they said, and they would discover that they had agreed with each other as a result of his summary. A great talent." Hawkins had met Frank Oppenheimer at Stanford, and, like Frank, he joined the Communist Party in late 1937. Like the Oppenheimer brothers and many other academics, he was incensed by the anti-labor vigilantism sweeping California's farm factories. Even so, his political activities were very much part-time. He didn't meet a full-time party functionary like Steve Nelson until sometime in 1940. Like many in the academy, Hawkins felt it necessary to hide his affiliation with the party. "We were pretty secretive," he said. "We would have lost our jobs. You could be on the left, you could engage in some of these activities, but you couldn't say, 'I'm a Communist Party member.'" Hawkins didn't think about revolution either. "The centralization of a technological society," he later said, "made it very hard to think about barricades in the streets. We were self-consciously a left-wing component of the New Deal. We were pulling the New Deal to the left. That was our mission in life." It was an accurate description of Robert Oppenheimer's political objectives as well as his own. By 1941, Hawkins was active in local campus politics as a junior faculty member in the philosophy department. He participated in the same study groups attended by Weinberg, Morrison, and others in private homes around Berkeley. "We were all very much interested in historical materialism and the theory of history," Hawkins recalled. "I was very much impressed with Phil, and he and I became close friends." Some of these meetings occurred in Oppenheimer's home. When asked years later whether he thought Oppenheimer had been a member of the party, Hawkins replied, "Not that I know of. But you know, again, I would say it wouldn't have mattered very much. In a sense, it's not an important question. He was clearly identified with many of these left-wing activities." Martin D. Kamen was another of Oppie's acolytes. A chemist by training, he had written his doctoral dissertation in Chicago on a problem in nuclear physics. In just a few years, he and another chemist, Sam Rubin, would use Lorentz's cyclotron to discover the radioactive isotope carbon-14. In early 1937, he followed a girlfriend to Berkeley, where Ernest Lawrence hired him for $1,000 a year to work in the Rad Lab. It was like Mecca, Kamen recalled at Berkeley. Oppenheimer quickly learned that Kamen was a serious musician. He played the violin with Frank Oppenheimer and enjoyed talking about literature and music. I think he took a shine to me, Kamen said, because I could talk to him about things other than physics. They spent a lot of time together from 1937 until the war broke out. Like everyone else who entered Oppenheimer's circle, Kamen admired the charismatic physicist. Everyone sort of regarded him very affectionately as being sort of nuts, Kamen said. He was very brilliant, but somehow superficial. He had the approach of a dilettante. At times, Kamen thought Oppie's eccentricities were calculated performances. Kamen recalled going with him to a New Year's Eve party at Estelle Kane's home. On the drive over, Oppie said he knew Estelle lived on a particular street, but he had forgotten the number of the house. He remembered only that it was a multiple of 7. So we drove up and down the street, Kamen recalled, and finally found number 3528. A multiple of 7, all right. Thinking about it now, I wonder sometimes whether he wasn't pulling everybody's leg a little bit. He had this overwhelming temptation just to snow you. Kamen was no left-wing activist, and he certainly was never a communist. But he joined Oppenheimer on the Berkeley cocktail circuit, attending various fundraising affairs for the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee and Russian War Relief. Oppenheimer also involved him in an ill-fated attempt to organize a union at the radiation laboratory. It all began with a labor union election fight inside the Shell Development Company's plant in nearby Emeryville. Shell had a large number of white-collar workers, engineers, and chemists who had PhDs, many from Berkeley. A Congress of Industrial Organizations, CIO, sponsored union, the Federation of Architects, Engineers, Chemists, and Technicians, FAECT-CIO, launched an organizing drive in the plant. In response, Shell management was encouraging its employees to join a company union. At one point, a Shell chemist named David Adelson appealed to Oppenheimer to lend his prestige to the FAECT organizing drive. Adelson belonged to a professional unit of the Alameda County, California, Communist Party, and he thought Oppenheimer would be sympathetic. He was right. One evening, Oppenheimer gave a union-sponsored talk at the Berkeley home of one of his former graduate students, Hervé Vogue, who was then employed by Shell. More than 15 people attended and listened respectfully as Oppenheimer talked about the likelihood of America getting into the war. "When he spoke," recalled Vogue, "everyone listened." In the autumn of 1941, Oppenheimer agreed to hold an organizing meeting in his Eagle Hill home, and, among others, he invited Martin Kamen to attend. "I was not happy about that," recalled Kamen, "but I said, 'Yes, I'll come.'" Kamen was worried about the notion of recruiting employees of the radiation lab, who were now essentially working for the U.S. Army and had signed security pledges, into a controversial union like FAECT. But he came to the meeting and listened to Oppenheimer's union pitch. 15 people were present, including Oppenheimer's psychologist friend Ernest Hilgard, Joe Hildebrand of the Berkeley Chemistry Department, and a young British chemical engineer, George C. Eltonton, employed by the Shell Development Company. "We all sat in a circle in Oppenheimer's living room," Kamen recalled. "Everybody said, 'Yeah, it's great. It's marvelous.' When it came Kamen's turn to speak, he said, 'Wait, has anybody told Ernest Lawrence about this? We're working in the radiation lab and we have no independence in this matter. We have to get the permission of Lawrence on this.'" Oppenheimer had not anticipated this consideration, and Kamen thought he seemed shaken by his interruption. The two-hour meeting broke up without the unanimous support Oppenheimer had expected. A couple of days later, he found Kamen and said, "Gee, I don't know, maybe I did the wrong thing." He then explained, "I went to see Lawrence, and Lawrence blew a gasket." Lawrence, whose politics had become increasingly conservative over the years, was incensed that a communist-backed union was trying to organize the people in his laboratory. When he demanded to know who was behind this, Oppenheimer insisted, "I can't tell you who they are. They'll have to come tell you themselves." Lawrence was furious, not only because he was violently opposed to his physicists and chemists joining a union, but because the incident demonstrated that his old friend was still wasting his precious time on left-wing politics. Lawrence had repeatedly scolded Oppenheimer about his left-wandering activities, but once again Oppie argued with his usual eloquence that scientists had a responsibility to help society's underdogs. No wonder Lawrence was annoyed. That autumn, Lawrence was trying, unsuccessfully, to bring Oppenheimer aboard the bomb project. "If he would just stop these nonsensical things," he complained to Kamen, "we could get him on the project, but it's impossible to get the army to accept him."